Hello and welcome to the NBA Outlet. I'm your host, Nick Fay. With me, as always, Corey Waldron and pretty much a co-host on the show now, Jack Manuel. What's up, guys?
I've been in three different time zones in the past 24 hours. My body is going through a lot.
It's a dedication. Obviously, we're not all together for this edition of recording an episode, but it was fun to all get together last week in playoffs.
Playoffs. That's what we'll be talking about today. All different types of stuff. Should be a really interesting show. Obviously, Corey and Jack combo always bring some fun. Now, did you guys want to start with the East or the West?
The East has the Brooklyn Nets and the Indiana Pacers, so it makes the most sense.
Okay, that's fair enough. So let's start with Toronto and Orlando, who are going to play tonight. Series is 1-1. Obviously, Game 3 is going to be huge. Toronto had a pretty solid victory over Orlando in Game 2, 111-82. Thoughts on this series?
Yeah, I mean, Kawhi Leonard looks done with it. For those who haven't seen the photo going around where it's just him in the most despondent face of all time, he's just like, we're going to win three more times against these guys. It's a quality tweet for whoever put that out there. Shout out to whoever you are. But I think that the momentum swing has already happened. It seems very, very likely that the Toronto Raptors close this out in however many games. I think that game one, I think aberration is a bit of a strong word, but you're not going to get many more DJ Augustine performances like that again. But and I think that they need someone like Nikola Vucevic to step up. We need a signature game from their all-star if they're going to, you know, get back on track and take the lead in this series, because I think that he's due for a big game. But Marc Gasol is just such a tremendous matchup for him. I think as well, Nick Cavallo, awesome writer for OTG, asked us if we're in due for a Serge Ibaka big performance this game.
I mean, he's been relatively quiet, so I think Ibaka is due for a breakout game at some point. I mean, the one thing in Orlando's favor is obviously they stole game one, which obviously at this point, after seeing game two, looks like an outlier. They hit more threes. I think they had under 10 threes in game two. As we know, Kawhi was 15 for 22 in the field in game two, completely dominated. And Lowry actually hit buckets, which was a huge bonus for the Toronto Raptors. Siakam was solid. I've loved Aaron Gordon for the Orlando Magic, but again, like, there's only so much you can do if you're not going to be a three-point shooting team, or at least hit your threes. So I actually think they shot more threes than Toronto did in the second game. They just didn't get as many to fall, obviously. So looking at game three, obviously, Orlando, you know, I felt this way kind of last night about Brooklyn, although Brooklyn didn't get the win. Sorry, Nick and Jack. But I think the fact that Orlando hasn't been in the playoffs for so long that I expect game three in Orlando to be kind of rocking. So if Orlando can kind of use that extra juice from home to get going early, I think that would be huge for them to set the tempo. But again, you know, Toronto looks really pissed off for that, the fact that they lost game one. And again, they didn't get blown out in game one. They lost by 3 points, and they were right in it until the very end. In game two, they'd make quick work of them.
Yeah, you could feel the engagement level of Toronto in game two really pick up, especially defensively. And it was like, all right, you know, we weren't at our best in game one, and now we're going to turn it up. But you brought up some great points, Jack. Vucevic, feel like he really needs to step up his game if they want to win this series. Marc Gasol's really had his number overall as a defense. They've done a great job on him. Corey, the point you made about three-point shooting, and I think we brought it up when we did the live recap, was it felt like a real outlier for Orlando to shoot that well from three. DJ Augustine as well obviously had that crazy game. I think game three, the best thing for Orlando to do here is build up that momentum that they have from the home crowd, not having a playoff game in so long, and see what they can do and try to build off that. Because if they lose this game, I think most of us would agree the series is probably going to end in five.
Yeah, I would say that, definitely.
Yeah, or, if they don't win tonight, the series is over in five. Obviously, I picked Orlando in six. So for me, this is like the pivotal game for them to win.
Orlando in six.
Sorry.
We said it out loud. We didn't.
I said Toronto in six was my actual prediction. Check the tape.
He has receipts.
One more thing I can say, though, about Orlando is Terrence Ross, who was crucial for them off the bench, is shooting just 33% from the field so far this series, 33% from three. He's crucial for the Orlando Magic, probably their best three-point shooter. He's got to be big tonight for them at home.
Former Raptor.
He definitely Yeah, former Raptor, revenge game, talking about that. And just to touch on Nick's point real quick, Serge Ibaka is just a type that he could get hot randomly from three and have a big game. I know, Jack, we saw that happen against the Nets in the second to last week of the season, where he just caught fire with his jump shot. I don't think he's a guy they're going to look to create for, but if the openings are there, I could see Serge having a nice game.
Yeah, I think because the Magic have a lot of quality bigs, they match up pretty well with a guy like Serge Ibaka. You know, Jonathan Isaac's really good, whereas, you know, the wing depth they certainly don't have, which is what allowed Kawhi to dominate in the previous game. So, you know, if we get another big Kawhi performance, it's lights out for the Orlando Magic.
And
go ahead, Corey.
Sorry. Just as another thing for Orlando, turnovers were crucial in game two. Orlando had 17 turnovers. The Raptors only had 7. So for Orlando, you got to take care of the basketball. You can't let a defensive unit like Toronto force you into turnovers and to be able to get out in transition. That would be crucial for them at home.
Yeah, and I can't believe I really didn't talk about Kawhi, but he was just straight lethal in that game. Like, just watching it from the tip, you knew that he was taking over that game and he was just going to dominate. And that was, like, top five player performance, MVP-type performance. He just had control and no one could do anything about it.
And what did
we sleeping on? I was going to say, like, are we sleeping on Kawhi a little bit?
I personally don't think I ever sleep on Kawhi, but I know a lot of NBA media narratives definitely do.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. I don't sleep on Kawhi. I know Kawhi is fantastic, but we mentioned this on the recap show for game one, if we recall. We had mentioned how Kawhi we felt was underutilized in game one. It felt like you didn't get going till late. In game two, they made a strong vocal point to make sure they got him going early and they got him getting going.
Point, Corey.
Focal. With an F. F-O-C-A-L. I know. I had trouble, all right? Words.
It's not a European word, though, my dude. It's not a European
thing. But really, though, Kawhi probably could have dropped 50 in that game if he needed to. It was just a point where, like, all right, Orlando, you're down big. Doesn't really necessarily matter. Any other thoughts on that series before we move on to the most exciting series to talk about in the playoffs?
Yeah, let's go on to the next one.
Could you make a guess? It's going to be Milwaukee and Detroit. This is what everybody's talking about.
Can we go to the next one after that one?
I honestly, I can't even lie to you. I didn't watch any bit of game two. I mean,
I haven't watched any of this series. I'm being real right now, and it might make me come off as, you know, a bit of an idiot. But like the time the games are on, I was in the Northern Hemisphere. I'm like, it's on the same time as the Pacers Celtics game. I'd rather watch that one. No, I think that there is. Funnily enough, though, when I was watching it on the Reddit stream, the Celtics Pacers game, there was moments where I'm like, oh, the Pistons are down by 3, and then like I would go out at halftime to get. I went to Trader Joe's to get me some snacks and. It's quality stuff at Trader Joe's.
Trader Joe's has A1 snacks, like some of the best healthy snacks you can find.
And I did not go to down the healthy route, unfortunately.
But like their bad things are still like relatively healthy because they're organic, like compared to like it's not all processed.
That's
but,
it. And
we could go on a long spiel about snacks, but
we certainly could. But I mean, that's how interesting this Pistons Bucks series is. I care more about my snack game than staying rejuvenated for the Jazz Houston series, which hasn't been great either. But yeah, there hasn't been a lot to speak about. Giannis is good at basketball. Pat Connaughton's a nice little thing. And Thon Maker. Nice little
thing. You'd appreciate that.
Yeah, Thon Maker probably shouldn't have left the Milwaukee Bucks either.
Yeah, I mean, I've watched the first, I think, 8 or 6 minutes of game one, and they were already out to a giant lead. I didn't watch any game two because the game was obviously on when the Pacers and Celtics were playing. And no offense, I'm not watching that over my team, even though that my team continues to break my heart, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But the Pistons just aren't a very good team. They just don't match up well. I think the best thing for the Pistons has been the fact that Luke Kennard just looks really good. I mean, he had a really big game too. So I think you like him going forward, the fact that they obviously kind of lack shooting all year long. So I think that's been a nice plus. The Blake Griffin thing is kind of questionable because he had a statement, I think, before game two where he said, like, he wants to play, but the team isn't letting him play, which to me just means the team knows we're going to get beat. Why have him play? Like, just let him rest. But Milwaukee looks dominant. I mean, Milwaukee's going to probably win this in 4 games. Like you mentioned, Pat Connaughton's been good. George Hill had a very good game one. Mirotic is still trying to get into rhythm. Antetokounmpo in game one played, what, I think 23 minutes and had, you know, 23 and 17, the usual BS from the Greek Freak. So Detroit just has been outmatched. The Bucks in 4 looks still really good.
Bucks in 3.
Seriously, if they could end it in 3, I think they should, but obviously it's not going to happen. You mentioned Luke Kennard. He's actually been really good. And on the Blake front, I think sometimes it's, you know, like they thought they're going to lose, but also it's a fact is like a player's always going to say they want to play, even if medically they're not supposed to. You don't see it as much in the NBA because it seems like they're more accepting in terms of like the medical staff, but in the NFL, you'll hear it a lot like, hey, I really wanted to play, but he's like, your knee's going to really get screwed up if you do that.
Right. It's a good point.
But anything else on this amazing series?
It's a bit sad for Blake in that sort of sense, because he's had such an awesome season, and to sort of have the prime time to be able to show yourself and make a name for yourself taken away. It seems like a cruel sort of story, similar in ways, I guess, to Paul George. But this is the sort of point end of the season, and it just sucks that we don't get to see the best players at their fullest health be able to shut their stuff.
I have two questions for you guys. One, do you think some of that falls on Detroit and Dwayne Casey for the way they manage his minutes throughout the season? Because I did hear a lot from Pistons media and fans that, you know, Blake was getting overplayed at certain points of the year.
Yes, but also I think that because they were in such a race to just make the playoffs, you sort of need him in that sense. Mm-hmm. And had they have gotten the sixth seed against Philly, had they got the seventh seed against Toronto, I think they would probably be experiencing a similar sort of decline. But it's that catch sort of 22. You know, you want to have your, because he missed the last sort of couple of regular season games as well. So it's not that this thing is, you know, a sort of rolled ankle is going to be back in the next game or two. It's lingering. So I think that it's certainly a catch 22 situation. And I think that man management, yeah, a lot of that does go in the organization. But at the same time, you know, you're probably not going to stop a guy like Blake Griffin from wanting to play basketball. But his long-term future is what's important, because I think Dwayne Casey's even said that, like, this is sort of a stepping stone going forward. Because if Blake's healthy next year and they manage him a little bit better, they get some nice pieces, like you sort of, Corey was saying, Luke Kennard continues his form, then I think that this team can probably stay around that sort of range. Maybe they had some shooters and role players, and they might be able to do something similar, if not a little bit better, with a healthy Blake Griffin, because he's one of the best players in the Eastern Conference.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's worrisome for Blake Griffin, who has an injury history. We've mentioned how his game obviously is completely changed from his Lob City days, where he was the high flyer. He's now a guy who's a little bit of everything. But again, like Jack mentioned, I mean, this Pistons team probably doesn't make the playoffs unless Blake Griffin is playing a ton of minutes down the stretch. Now, granted, he missed the last couple of games, and also he tried to play, if we recall. I think against Miami, he played like 23 minutes. I mean, he was god-awful, but he tried to play. Probably shouldn't have just had him play at all down the stretch there. But, you know, when you're trying to make the playoffs, especially for the Pistons, who are paying so much money to these big three guys, I know their attendance isn't great. They're probably, I don't know what their revenue is for the year, but it can't be that good. So I'm, because they don't ever sell out. I've never seen, I don't even know the name of their arena, but I never see
it. Caesar's. It's all about that pizza.
Okay. I never see it sold out.
Jack and I definitely know what it is.
So for me, I think that may be why, you know, also they were trying to get Blake out there, because you can't really, you know, it's still a business. They're trying to sell money, and him not being out there hurts. Like, I can only imagine how many people will be at game three tonight, or tomorrow, whenever game three is. I think, no, it's tonight, right? No, tomorrow. Sorry, I'm all over the place. But yeah, you know, it is what it is. Hopefully he gets healthy. And like Jack mentioned, hopefully they can add some nice shooters around. You know, maybe they can bring Wayne Ellington back. So I actually thought Wayne Ellington for them was really good down the stretch. And maybe he wants to get more minutes time. He goes there. I think Luke Kennard's a good guy going forward. But again, it's been all Bucks, and the Pistons are.
I think also the fact is, like, they probably could have managed his minutes a little bit better early in the year. I know, like, during late in the playoff race, you need to play him more, but I'm going all the way back, and there's times where I remember reading some guys, Detroit media or whoever, cover them and follow them, saying, like, Dwayne Casey was keeping him too long in blowouts and not trusting the other guys. Obviously, he doesn't have a lot of trust for that team. It's not an amazing team. My fear for them is they don't have great cap space. They can't really add other role players. They're just going to have to try to, like, find, you know, diamonds in the rough and kind of hope that they're going to work out for him. So, but my second question for you guys, would this series be any different if it was Orlando or Brooklyn? And, you know, obviously we're Nets fans, but Milwaukee is just a really dominant team.
Orlando, I think, would probably match up best out of those three teams, just because I think that they're the best defensive squad out of those three. I think the Nets will probably go down in four as well, maybe five, if we were to get one game and, you know, Giannis was just to fall over in some weird way, or, you know, Barclays crowd were to get to him or something. But I don't think that any other team would fare as well, because this Bucks team is on an absolute tear.
Yeah, I agree, I think Orlando will probably be the best matchup of those three teams. Not only that, because I think Vucevic, who's been a non-factor against the Raptors, probably has a good series against the Bucks, because I mean, he's matched up with Brook Lopez, who isn't a fantastic defender. He's been kind of flustered by the Serge Ibaka and the Marc Gasol combo. Uzun doesn't really get a break against Toronto. He may get a slight break against the Milwaukee Bucks. But again, we're talking about maybe a series going five games compared to four.
Yeah, that's what I think. I feel like Detroit's getting a lot of hate, but at the end of the day, any team that pretty much got matched up with Milwaukee in terms of the lower seeds was going to get cooked. Like, they're just a team that's really possessed right now, and they have a mission that's to win a championship. And you could definitely get that vibe. Let's start with Boston, Indiana, and we'll save the Nets for last for the Eastern Conference.
Corey?
Y'all are lucky Victor Oladipo is hurt! Let me tell you.
Oh, he's coming up. This is like some Stephen A. style court. I don't mind this.
I'm tired of Celtic fans out here tweeting, talking shit. Like, you guys are winning by more than 10 points. We don't even got our best player. You're barely winning. Barely. You should have lost game one. Well, maybe not game one. I'll give you game one. You should have lost game two. There was an 8-minute drought. Wesley Matthews. Marcus Smart isn't on the Pacers yet. Stop passing to him. It's frustrating. Victor Oladipo, the series is over in five, maybe six. But the Celtics have Kyrie Irving and Jason Tatum. Let me say, Jason Tatum, who was fantastic last year in the playoffs, might have played the best game of his career in game two. Giving up long twos and actually passing the ball, driving when he needed to. I thought he was actually phenomenal, and that's the reason why the Pacers, like, Kyrie, obviously, like, you know, Kyrie is going to beat you, but Jason Tatum to me was what stood out the most in game two. He was just phenomenal. And Al Horford was sick, and the Pacers, it just shows, like, when you don't have a guy who can create off the dribble and create his own shot, what it does, because the Pacers defense has been phenomenal. I mean, the Boston Celtics had not scored over 100 points. Granted, they had 99 in game two, but they really only should have 93 because the Pacers gave up 8 points in like 40 seconds to end that game, which helped a lot of people in Vegas because the spread was 7.5. And the Celtics were not going to cover that, but they did. But yeah, and Tyreke Evans, I can't wait to see you gone because you're just annoying to watch at this point. But
a lot of digest right there, Jack.
Yeah,
I think that you know how you can edit photos and like color them in different colors or whatever. I feel like, you know, we got the red text on Corey, then just colored him in red his entire face. The response to that, I don't know what to say. I will agree with basically everything that Corey said. I think that the Indiana has done a lot of things right. It's just that they don't have enough talent to counter a Boston Celtics team that has Kyrie Irving. It's as simple as that. Victor Oladipo's there. It could be a very, very different story. I think that they made a lot of mistakes in those third and fourth quarters as well. Almost cost themselves the game. Wesley Matthews, I don't know what was going on through his head, despite the fact that he has been very good for them since his arrival. But the turnovers, the inability to score. I think that one guy I really like in his limited amount of time and can create a little bit, just a little bit. And he did supersede TJ Leaf in the rotation was Aaron Holiday. I like his minutes when he's out there. Just another ball handler, another guy who can do something. A little bit of athleticism as well, which I think the pace is lacking a bit. So I'd like to see him a little bit more in game three when they head back home.
Yeah, you can give him a little bit of a spark just being a young body. Even watching him play a little bit during the regular season, he seems very confident for a rookie. Obviously, his defense isn't quite there yet. But I think my biggest concern going into the series was how do the Pacers score when things get tough and they stop, you know, being able to run their offense. And the issue has been they haven't been able to score. You know, it's like you ask Bogdanovich to go one-on-one with Jaylen Brown. You know, give me Jaylen Brown in that situation. Like, it's not like Bogdanovich is a bad player, but he's not really amazing at creating for himself, especially when the defense knows there's only so many guys on the floor that are really lethal offensive players.
And it's funny. I'll just quickly get to the comments, Corey, before you add to that. Miguel actually echoed that point as well that you made, Nick, and Boyan can't be the focal point. Focal, and he put in quotation marks, focal, not vocal. He put it with an F. And Karen's jumped in as well. Apparently, Corey, you need to turn it down a little bit because you nearly broke her phone. And you just turn it down a little bit, mate. But you know,
I'm a little hyped up, you know, a little excited.
And obviously, Miguel echoed the sentiments that Oladipo is greatly missed. And apparently, Jorge thinks that the Heat would have stolen one game from the Bucks. I don't know about that.
Yo, Jorge, what?
Are you sipping the Kool-Aid?
Let's get a Jorge's comment real quick. Yo, here at the bottom of my list to steal a game, I'm giving Detroit almost as much of a chance as I'm giving Miami. Miami's missing their best player. Richardson's out.
What, Dwayne Wade?
Yeah, if Richardson was healthy, I may give him like one. I might maybe get one game, but without Richardson, definitely not.
Dude, the Bucks are shooting them out of the gym. The Heat have a hard enough time probably scoring 100 points with like mediocre defense against and like a good defense like Milwaukee. And the way Milwaukee's playing, like, stop, Jorge.
Jorge's leaving OTG. He's upset.
But Connor, what were you going to say?
I was just saying, just to like Wesley Matthews, like, I know the turnover at the end of game two was really bad, but actually the worst play that he made came like 30 seconds before that. I don't know if you guys watched that. I don't know if you guys saw the game, but the Pacers were, they were down by two or down by one or whatever. And there was like late in the shot clock. Miles Turner got it at the top of the key and he's dribbling. And Wesley Matthews gets the ball with like 5 seconds. And it was one of those like passes where you're like, oh shit, he's going to shoot this. And he like faded out of bounds to shoot a three. So he's just questionable. And then just now to the main point, Sabonis only had one shot in game two.
Let's get to that real quick. Now, Sabonis, now let's say, who do you put the most blame on? Is that on Sabonis because he's not being aggressive enough? Is that on his teammates not getting him the ball? Or is that Nate McMillan not going to his team and saying, yo, Sabonis needs 15 shots or 10 shots?
First of all, it is credit to the Boston Celtics defense because they have done a great job of limiting the Pacers' pick and roll. They're not letting Sabonis get into his spots. They're cutting off the lane so Tyreke Evans and Corey Joseph and Darren Collins can't find Domantas Sabonis. But at the end of the day, Domantas Sabonis, you know, it's Nate McMillan. You got to figure out ways, you know, maybe more screens or somehow to get Sabonis more touches down low in the paint to get him effective. And then Miles Turner, I think he's taken 13 shots between two games. Miles Turner has got to be getting more looks. And I get it. He's not an aggressive offensive threat, but there's got to be ways because there's too many times, especially the Wesley Matthews fadeaway three I mentioned. If Miles Turner was aggressive, he had like 7 feet of space between him and Al Horford, but he was looking for somebody else. Get aggressive and take the open looks. Because as we mentioned before this series started, if the Pacers wanted to win, it's going to lead on the young guys, Miles Turner, Domantas Sabonis, to kind of carry the load. They got to be effective. And, you know, one shot a game and 5 shots a game from those two guys just isn't going to cut it.
And I 100% agree. I think you need to get those. I've talked to you before about Miles Turner, like just need to be more aggressive. There was a game, I want to say it was game one, where he shot X amount of times in the second half or whatever it may be. And I was like, he could shoot that many times from three and I wouldn't even be upset about it, because at this point, they're missing your best offensive player. Other guys are going to have to step up.
Yeah, and Al Horford, from what I've noticed in game one and two, that he gives him space. When Miles Turner comes out of the paint, Al Horford doesn't play him tight. Al Horford gives him space.
In response to your Heat comment, Jorge, Sixers in five, apparently. Miguel isn't happy about that, obviously, a regular Brooklyn Buzz listener. Should we get to that series, Nick?
Yeah, I guess I have to relive last night. Yeah. So game three, obviously, Nets had the L. Sixers took care of business. Joel Embiid did not play. It was announced, I want to say, like 5 minutes before the game even started, because I was walking in the arena and I got the update. Ben Simmons went on a tear after Jared Dudley said he was averaging the half court. So, I mean, a lot of it was the Nets just couldn't stop Philly.
And Embiid has been, just recent news, he was questionable earlier in the day. He's been downgraded to doubtful. Ed Davis is also out. I think a lot of people were questioning why wasn't Ed Davis playing any minutes. It seemed likely. You guys discussed it on The Buzz, you and Will Jackson. Make sure you subscribe to that on iTunes. Catching that on YouTube as well. Lots of love there. I think that there's a lot that needs to happen in this series for the Nets to get back on board, but they are manageable changes. I think a lot of that goes back to the coaching staff. Landing and seeing all the reaction on Twitter, listening to The Buzz. I think a lot of changes can be made to sort of react, because we saw game one. We watched it. All three of us were there together. There was the recipe. And the fact that we had the recipe, it's like we've gone away and we just added in these new different things. And yes, the Sixers have reacted in a positive way. And Ben Simmons is better than Jared Dudley. Or surprise, surprise.
hot take.
It's a massively hot take, apparently. I just think that we need to get back to the simple things, you know. Let's play our guards a lot. Our guards are our best players and our best weapons against this Sixers team. Let's play some defense. Let's get some looks for Joe Harris. Let's not play Joe Harris the most amount of minutes, as much as it pains me to say, if he's not playing well, if he's not getting his three-point shot off. There's a lot of things that can easily be managed. Jared Allen has been better in the absence of Joel Embiid, and I think he can do that again in game four. So there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen. But I think a lot of it can be managed, and a lot of that is on Coach Kenny, as well as the players just playing some bloody defense.
Yeah, I mean, last night was a lot to digest. Sorry, guys. This is tough for you guys. Because I mean, going into the game, I felt good for Brooklyn. When I saw Joel Embiid out, I was like, wow, like this is a great opportunity for the Nets. And now him being doubtful for game four, to me that just means that the Sixers don't care if they lose game four almost.
Ooh.
That's how I take that.
I kind of agree with Corey there. I think if they lost game three, Embiid would be more likely to play game four. But now that they got the split, if they could even end up winning both games, we don't know what's gonna happen.
Right.
But they walk away 2-2, we have home court the rest of the way.
Right. And then, you know, looking at Ben Simmons, I mean, that might have been one of the most aggressive Ben Simmons performances I've seen this year. Just aggressive in the half court, aggressive in transition. I mean, there was several times where he dunked and just screamed, the stare downs, him laughing at Dudley, which was whatever. But he just had a different aura. I mean, I think he's kind of an arrogant guy at times, but he just came to play. And then you had Tobias Harris, who finally had his best game of his entire playoff career. I think he was, what, 6-for-6 from three or 6-for-7 from three?
Six from three.
Yeah, so he was really locked in. J.J. Redick finally got loose, which was an issue. So it was finally just like, you know, no Joel Embiid, but then everyone else seemed to step up for the Philadelphia 76ers. And then from Brooklyn's standpoint, I mean, Joe Harris has been a minus 65 on the floor so far this series. He's just getting beat, which is unfortunate because he's probably the Nets' best three-point shooter. He is the Nets' best three-point shooter.
Three-point shooter in the NBA this year in terms of percentage.
Well, there you go. So that's an issue. How can you get him effective offensively but then not have it be a defensive liability? And then Dudley, to me, even though he played yesterday, I don't think he looked good. I think he's hurt still. I think it was just one of those games where he wanted to play. Ed Davis obviously had that ankle roll in game one. Or was it game one? And that clearly affected him. I thought Jared Allen was really good last night. That was a nice plus. And then Caris LeVert was an absolute stud. And this was my biggest issue last night with Kenny Atkinson.
Atkinson.
Atkinson was the fact. I'm sorry, Jack. I'm trying here. But I don't know why he waited so long to put Caris in the third. Now, granted, I know
that is why he didn't start the third.
That's another great point. With that 19-point second quarter, he dominated. I mean, that was one of the best stretches I've seen of Caris LeVert pre-ankle or post-ankle injury.
One of his best stretches of entire career.
Right, and I questioned Kenny for waiting so long to put him in the third quarter, because even in the third quarter, you know, that's when JJ got really hot in the third quarter. You put Caris out, maybe Caris starts D'ing up JJ, and you can kind of limit JJ. I just thought that was probably the worst mistake Kenny made, was waiting so late to go to Caris LeVert. And I already know, I saw the tweet that he's not against playing Dinwiddie, Russell, and Caris LeVert maybe 30 to even 40 minutes. And I almost think they got to play 35-plus. Let those three guards play. They're your best offensive options.
Yeah, Will brought it up in the chat as well, Will Jackson.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this. We talked about this after game two. I was advocating for the Nets to make a lineup change, and I feel two of the three guards have to be on the floor at all times. Is it Dinwiddie and D'Lo and LeVert, Dinwiddie and LeVert, whatever it may be. I think you got to play those guys. And the way LeVert's playing this entire series, offensively, he's the only guy who's consistently getting in the paint and getting his shots up and what he has to do. And then also defensively, he's the one guard that hasn't been a liability, and he actually offers you some versatility where he can guard maybe a little bit of the bigger guys. Like, he was on Tobias Harris for a little bit. I felt like he did a solid job. You know, he was in there getting some steals. He's active with his hands off ball as well defensively, where it's like Kenny has to make adjustments in this game. I felt like last game he did not react quick enough on a lot of aspects of the game. And some of that, and Jack and I talking to DMs, is the fact they probably thought Embiid was playing, and the fact he wasn't playing completely changed the whole scheme that Philly was throwing at them, because they played a little bit small ball. But I think overall, the coaching, we talked about the coaching matchup in game one, it went to Kenny. Game three, coaching matchup went to Brett Brown for sure.
And game two as well, obviously.
Yeah. And I think game two was a little bit on the players though, like not just Kenny, because like you let up 40 plus in a quarter, you just sucked that quarter.
I have literally just looked up on NBA.com three-man lineup. Spencer Dinwiddie, D'Angelo Russell, Caris LeVert together. This isn't going to bode well, but it's obviously small sample size. In 123 minutes in the regular season, they have a minus 13.4 net rating. Obviously, small sample size, and take with it what you will. I think it'll be much more effective against the Philadelphia 76ers.
Squad. Regular season versus playoff too, which I think game gets a lot different in terms of isolation.
Exactly. And Miguel's also advocated for a bit more Rondé possibly as well, that the energy that he gives. There's a lot of adjustments that can be made to get the Nets back into this series. We're only 2-1 down. It feels like that, you know, obviously it feels a lot worse, but we win game four, then this is a series. We can take this to seven. We can really win this. But game four is the most important game since I've been a Nets fan, and probably the most important Brooklyn Nets home game maybe ever in Brooklyn.
Yeah. I mean, Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, I was really impressed with. I mean, obviously, he didn't play a lot in game one and game two. He didn't play at all in game one. Did he play in game two?
Game two, he got somewhat garbage comeback.
Right,
slash garbage.
Right. But I thought he was actually really good down the stretch. But then, like, the first half of the fourth quarter, I thought he was really good. And then the second half of the fourth quarter, I felt like he was just trying to do too much offensively. But, I mean, you know, 10 of 13 from the line. He got to the line. I thought that was really big for Rondae. But, again, like, Damari Carroll, only shooting 28% this series. He's got to be better. I know he had a couple misses late in the fourth. You know,
the forward position in general, it's Damari, it's Rodions, it's Trevion Graham. You want to call Joe Harris a small forward, whatever it may be.
Yeah.
You need more production out of that. Last night, you got good production out of Karis, D'Lo, Jared Allen. I thought another mistake, and not to, you know, keep bashing Kenny. Yeah, a lot of people know I advocate for him. But Jared Allen should have played more minutes. He was impactful in that game, and he's too quick for Boban, and he's the only guy in the Nets, especially if Ed Davis is banged up, that has the length to match up with him, and Joel Embiid's not in there to get him in foul trouble.
That's actually a great point. Actually, in the fourth quarter, that first half, when they had that comeback stretch, and they cut it down to, I think, seven or maybe even six.
Six. D'Lo hit a big three, and it was down to six, and Brett Brown called a timeout, and then Sixers took
and
their business.
He kept Rondae in. I get it, because that five was rolling, but that was when Jared Allen needed to come back in. He put Jared Allen in that fourth quarter way too late. It was like 3 minutes too late to put Jared Allen in, because you're right. Jared Allen only playing 21 minutes in a game where there's no Joel Embiid, Boban with 5,000 foul trouble. There's no reason Jared Allen should not have been in the game.
I thought it was his best game of the series, too.
And this is just for you guys, because I don't – what is up with I'm going to butcher his name.
Rodions.
Yeah.
No, don't tell him how to say it.
Rodions. What's up with Rodions?
Oh, come on. Rodion Kurucs. I've mentioned this before in the game one and just in general about his late season form. He's a rookie. You can't expect a lot from a second round rookie in this sort of series. I think that he's not going to be a game changer. I think he'll be a game changer in moments, if anything. I think that he hasn't done necessarily anything horrible, but he hasn't done necessarily anything incredibly positive at the same time. I think he's been sort of just an afterthought in this series so far. We need some sort of steel slams from him. We need him to get into maybe Ben Simmons' skin a little bit. You know, just give him something to narrow his focus. I think that he can be, you know, a defensive sort of stopper to an extent, because he did it in Blake Griffin. He got in Blake Griffin's head, you know, tremendously in some regular season games. So I think Rodion Kurucs has the potential to make an impact in this series. It's just whether, you know, he's given the role and the narrowed focus to do so. A lot of it does come down to him, because whether he gets out of that starting lineup, you put in Caris LeVert as well, change his role and be a sort of spark plug off the bench. I think that could be beneficial possibly, but we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, Rodion isn't necessarily going to win us game four or game five or whatever it is, but he'll have moments where he can just lift the team, and especially at home, I think could really lift the home crowd.
Yeah, I think he's not going to win or probably lose you the series. He could have a positive or negative impact in the results. But like you said, Jack, he's a second-round rookie. You're not really necessarily expecting a lot out of him. I was surprised, to be honest, he lasted this long in the starting lineup. Like I said, I wanted him to change the starting lineup for game three. Going to game four, it looks like Kenny's going to make a change. What do you guys think is going to happen? Jack, Will and I discuss this on The Buzz.
Caris LeVert for Rodion Kurucs.
I would agree. I think LeVert should be in the starting lineup. Keep Dinwiddie at the second unit. You got to have, I think, a point guard, a solid point guard to run a second unit. So I would like to see Dinwiddie stay with the second unit. But LeVert's got to be starting. I don't think, especially after the second quarter, how he even played down the stretch in the fourth quarter, you got to have LeVert in. And like Nick said, he might even be the best player so far for Brooklyn in this series. I mean, I liked what D'Lo has done. The second half of game one was phenomenal. You know, he was still solid last night. But I mean, he had like the team worst plus minus. I think he was like minus 26 D'Lo. But I would definitely put LeVert in the starting lineup.
Yeah, I think the thing with D'Angelo is just you want more consistency across the entire game. Instead of having, you know, a good quarter, a good stretch here, you want to see him be more proactive. And I think some of that will help when you get LeVert in the starting lineup. I made the same change, Will and I, LeVert in for Rodions, because it'll open up more things for him as a ball handler. And LeVert, like I said, gives you someone defensively who can be a pest, who can be annoying, get his hands in there and force a steal or two. And right now, defensively, they're not having any success. And just a quick note on this. If you were going to make a defensive change for the Nets for game four, what would that defensive change be?
Just lock in on the perimeter. And I think that it's hard to sort of narrow it down into one thing, because I think that systematically things have just fallen down a hole. And I think that there just needs to be more defensive engagement and communication, you know, locking down on guys like JJ Redick, locking down on that perimeter, because we need to win the perimeter battle against this Sixers team. We have more perimeter talent in terms of being able to hit the three. It's going to be interesting to see, because we saw Brett Brown playing Ben Simmons at the five a little bit as well. How that coaching battle continues, as we mentioned after game one when I was back with you guys in Stanford, is going to dictate how this series pans out, because right now it's the likely first round that could pan out the longest. But at the same time, you know, the Blazers and Thunder, I think the Thunder might get back on track when they head back home too.
I mean, I'm right there with you. It's defensively limiting the perimeter shots. Obviously, the Nets were what? They were the best defensive team from the three-point line, or they were the top five in three-point defense?
In terms of being able to limit shots from the perimeter, we were good at it. But I remember mentioning this to Nick as well. The Bucks allowed the most and the Pacers allowed the most. It was just they were so good at protecting the paint, which I think that the Nets have been pretty poor at. And especially against a guy like Ben Simmons, where in game one, he wasn't getting anything, and I think that was partly because of Joel Embiid clogging up the paint a little bit. But at the same time, you have Boban out there and Greg Monroe. You know, those guys aren't necessarily perimeter threats at the same time. So I think there's some adjustments that can easily be made. But defensively, I think rebounding as well. There needs to be just a real focus on the defensive and offensive boards.
Yeah, there was a couple times last night they had really good defensive possessions, could not get the rebound. Also, I mentioned this to you, Jack. Philly made a nice adjustments where they're setting screens inside the paint so the help can't necessarily get over for Ben Simmons. So Ben Simmons is getting to the spot he likes, and we know when he really gets in his spots, he's going to knock it down. He doesn't have many spots, but the spots he does have, he kills it. Communication was an excellent point, Jack. I thought that was a major issue. And in terms of communication, I think there are situations where you just need to switch. Hey, you're going to get beat. You're not going to be able to recover in this situation. It's the playoffs. Adjust to it afterwards. Double team where you have to afterwards. But do not give up open looks, open threes, open layups, whatever it may be. I think there's plenty of adjustments like you talked about at the start. But
and I also, I want to say, I think the zone was really effective in the fourth quarter or early in the fourth quarter. I thought the zone was a good change. Obviously, it kind of broke down once Ben Simmons started getting a lot of easy looks at the rim. But I thought the zone was a nice switch up, because it looked like for a little bit that Philly didn't know how to get around it.
Yeah, I personally hate the zone in the playoffs, but that's just me. I think you can do it for like a play or two just to disrupt them. But if you run it for a stretch, it's the playoffs and they're eventually going to get a good shot. And I think like my main concept, if I was coaching defensively, would be like you want to disrupt their offense as much as possible. And sometimes when you play the zone, you give up an open shot just because the ball is going to move faster.
And we didn't play it in game one. We rarely, I think it was like 2-3 possessions, and we were locked in defensively. Yes, we gave up, you know, 110 points or so, but we just the defensive schemes just seemed to be very much down pat. But it feels like we just got another bonus buzz for anyone tuning in right now.
Yeah, and Will and I, this is just one last point, I guess. Will and I talked about this on the buzz, and I talked about if they're going to go small ball, you play Jared Allen and you put Jared Allen on Ben Simmons.
Yep. Yeah, I think that Will has mentioned that in the comments as well. But should we get to some of the other series, the less exciting ones, the ones we care about?
Yeah, you should probably get to the West, right? 45 minutes. We're about to have an hour and a half podcast.
Wouldn't be the first time.
No, definitely not. Not the last either.
So I guess we'll talk about the least exciting. I guess this is somewhat exciting, but really, I mean, if you're looking forward, it's not going to be that exciting. Golden State, Clippers. Obviously, Clippers had that 31-point comeback in game two, but Golden State went out and took care of business. KD was just looking lethal as hell. Thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think that there's been some fun with the Kevin Durant, Patrick Beverley thing, plenty of content around that. But I think Kevin Durant has proved that he is the best player in the NBA in this series. And I think that it's hard to sort of, you know, you can argue for James Harden and Giannis getting all the credit and stuff, but wonderful video as well the other day in terms of him breaking down what's happening in this series. I think we take KD for granted a little bit too much. I've always been a fan. Yes, the whole snake thing and then how he sort of reacts with the burners. But Kevin Durant, Will go down as a top 15 player probably in NBA history. One of the best small forwards, power forwards. He's as tall as a center. He's just one of the best shot makers in NBA history. He's just insane in his ability to get to whatever position he wants and just make buckets. He is an amazing player. And I think that take him away from this Golden State Warriors team, it'll be interesting to see how things even out when that probably likely eventuates. But it's funny. I think that this series, you know, there's going to be some moments. The Clippers are going to be feisty, but it's Golden State at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, if we're being real, this series should be over in four, but the Warriors do what they've been kind of doing this year, where they just took their foot off the gas in game two. They just got a little bit lazy. They weren't as locked in. And we see this from this Warriors team. They just haven't been able to be fully dominant all year long. They just have these stretches. Game three, to me, I mean, I only watched the first quarter and I think 3 minutes of the second quarter. I was like, there's nothing I need to watch here. They're not blowing this lead. Kevin Durant had 15 shots in the first half. I know in the one presser he had, he was like, I don't need to shoot over 20 times. And then he had 15 in the first half. It was like, I'll do whatever the hell I want. But realistically, you know, the game last night in particular, that was what, if that Warriors team plays like that, they're going to win another title. That is the Warriors at their best. They gave a fuck. They hit their shots. They looked dominant. They disrupted Lou Williams. They didn't let Lou Williams get anything easy, which really hurt the Clippers, especially in the late first, middle of the first quarter. I mean, Kevin Durant's phenomenal. As Jack mentioned, he's going to be a top 15 player all time. Stephen Curry is going to be a top 15 player all time, more than likely, when his career is done. Those two guys looked really good. That press conference of what Durant said following the Pat Beverly stuff, that Kevin Durant, I will take every day of the damn week. That was some of the best in-depth analysis from a player I've heard in a long time. I wish we got more of that from a guy like Kevin Durant, because it feels like oftentimes what we do hear clipped, it's him bitching or moaning about something. You know, we got the shining moment from the Clippers in game two, the 31-point comeback. That is not to be like wiped away or to be discredited. It was an incredible performance. I'm glad I stayed awake to catch it and actually watch it and experience it. It was something I haven't seen, especially it being an Oracle. But I mean, this is a series that's going to be over in five. The Clippers are a very tough knit group. I hope they get some sort of superstar or all-star this offseason, because I like what they have. But last night, you don't like what they have?
I know. I don't want them to get a superstar, because then it's more likely the Nets do.
Okay. Well, that's fair. But I really have liked what I saw from the Warriors last night. And I hope they carry this momentum. I want to say that game two was like a wake-up call, that we're not going to just coast, you know, through the playoffs to the finals again, especially when you have the Rockets a series ahead.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. It almost felt like game two was like the wake-up shot that they needed. It's like they got hit with an espresso shot. Like, now they're cooking and ready to go. And then, obviously, like, the Cousins injury made things a little bit more serious for them too. So now it's like, okay, we're, like, engaged. We're locked in. We can't take anything for granted, because much as we know, one of us could go down in one of the following games, and that could kind of screw up our whole chances. So, to be honest, like, if I'm the rest of the NBA, I'm almost kind of pissed that the Clippers had that 31-point comeback, because now Golden State is fully engaged, fully locked in. And, you know, this is a series that I won't watch a ton of, because I already know the outcome. But it will be interesting to see what happens when they match up with Houston next round, if Houston takes care of Utah as well.
Yeah, and on that, Adrian Dizon sort of echoed your sentiments, made him a little bit earlier, Nick. Cousins out allows the floor to open up a little bit more for KD. So his absence sort of maybe makes things a little bit easy for Kevin Durant. Sorry about that, Corey.
Go ahead, Corey.
The only thing I was going to say is I think in game four will prove if the Warriors are going to keep this run up, or if they, you know what I'm saying? Like, game four, they have to be just as dominant. If they take a step back, I'm going to feel some type of way. They need to carry this momentum to finish off this series.
Yeah, I think with Cousins going down, it's just like something they don't necessarily have to worry about. And that sounds weird saying it about an all-star level player in Cousins. But the fact is, it's the same, pretty much the same main core of last year. And they know what they have to do. They bring back Bogut, who's just a guy who's going to do the dirty work. So I think things are really looking nice for them. And then just touch on the KD thing, which I absolutely loved. And that made me gain back some of my love for Kevin Durant watching that video. I think some of it is on the media, because he said this before, ask me basketball questions. All they do is ask him questions about things that are irrelevant to the on the court stuff. If they probably asked him more questions like that, we'd get more breakdowns.
Yeah, that's true.
Fair point.
So I'll defend the players once in a while when I feel necessary, and that's a time. But talking Houston and Utah, Houston up 2-0 and a pretty commanding 2-0. And I know I took a vanilla take on the series, because I was a little bit scared and I wasn't sure if Houston was going to turn their gears all the way up. Houston turned their gears up, and so did James Harden.
James Harden certainly has. He's been reading the postseason narrative stuff. He must have been listening to JBT Redemption Narrative episode. I think that James Harden is making a point. And, you know, I think that the players around him, I think a guy, Daniel House, who we had a piece from, was it Mason who did a nice little piece on him on OTGBasketball.com? I think that his presence has added something. It seems to me that James Harden is making his teammates better. PJ Tucker, these guys around it. Eric Gordon's playing a little bit better, of basketball. And it also doesn't hurt that the Utah Jazz have just forgotten how to play defense or just playing absolutely abhorrent, incoherent defense on James Harden. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. They're making him look good. They're giving him what he wants. They're allowing him to penetrate and then kick out to shooters and allowing it to penetrate and then throw lobs to Clint Capella. The Utah Jazz have been horrible. But I think that the Houston Rockets on the other side have been better. So I think that it balances out.
I mean, James Harden has looked phenomenal. He's been by far the best player in this series, not even close. He's dominating. I mean, the start to game two was ridiculous. He had, I saw the breakdown. He was the entire offense between scoring and assisting. It was all James Harden. You're not going to win when that's happening. The defense, like you mentioned, Jack, they're playing to the left hand of Harden or the right hand. They're making Harden, you know, they're trying to give Harden, I don't know what they're trying to do. It ain't working. Ricky Rubio is playing behind James Harden. I guess if you think James Harden has, I don't know. It's been terrible. Rudy Gobert also, I'll say this right now, I'll take Miles Turner over Rudy Gobert any day of the week because Rudy Gobert, you take him out of the paint and he has to guard somebody on the perimeter. He can't do it. He can't move like that. Miles Turner, Kyrie Irving said that Miles Turner guards me on the perimeter a lot better than most guards do at times. Yeah. And that, he can just move better. Rudy Gobert can get exposed in a series like this too, where you get so spread out and spaced out because of the Rockets offense. Granted, the Celtics offense isn't like the Rockets, but the Rockets offense just space you out. Rudy Gobert becomes almost non-existent. He's just not that big of an impact defensive player in this matchup. And then Donovan Mitchell, it just goes to show if you don't have a lot of offensive weapons, your best offensive player is pretty much null and void. He just can't get anything going. Joe Ingles, a no-show. I think I picked Houston in six, and I'm shocked that I picked Houston in six because it doesn't even look like Utah can win a game. Granted, they're going back home. Their fans are a different animal. And maybe they'll get some more life. But Houston has just looked neck and shoulders way better than this Utah Jazz team.
Yeah, and on a talent perspective, you know, they obviously can probably compete with them. But schematically, like you talked about, Quinn Snyder has done a pretty bad job. Like, yeah. the gimmick defense they ran in game one, they ran it again in game two. It was terrible in game one, and game two was just as bad. They had confidence. You look at Utah's defenders trying to defend James Harden, they look scared. They're unsure of what they're supposed to do in the situation, and he's out there just embarrassing them. If he hit that one shot to start the first quarter where he sat there, that would have probably been the highlight of the year right there.
It was nasty.
Yeah, did you guys hear what PTI said about that?
Michael Wilbon, I didn't hear it all, but I just saw the headline. I'm going to say this. Michael Wilbon just has narratives on players he doesn't like because I remember he was on NBA something, you know, the halftime show, and they're talking about D'Angelo Russell being great. And he's like saying how D'Angelo's lucky that they traded him to Brooklyn. Like, okay, like you just clearly do not like players and he just clearly doesn't like James Harden.
For you, Jack, they called James Harden mean. Because he did a shimmy showing up the defensive player saying that was disrespectful and mean that he did that shimmy. And it shows that he has no respect for anybody and that he's a very mean guy. I can't believe they called him mean. I
don't know. Mean.
What is it? First grade?
Like Detroit, I'm pretty sure Mike Wilbon has been covering the NBA for a very long time and covered the Detroit Pistons bad boys. So I don't know if James Harden is mean for doing a shimmy, what he would be calling them, like murderers. But touching on the Houston Rockets a little bit and sort of relating to the Nets, Adrian has also jumped in the comments. Do you think the Nets could have utilized Fareed like the Rockets are doing now? I guess sort of it's like a spark plug off the bench, Nick.
I mean, I'm not playing him over Ed Davis. Ed Davis is healthy, and like he's only really playing the center position. So it's like if you think Fareed's better than Ed Davis, that's your opinion. I don't agree with it. I think Fareed's good in this specific role he's doing for Houston. And they also have some better defenders or guys that can kind of help out a little bit more where the Nets need their center to be good defensively. And Fareed, I don't think, is a good defensive player.
And I think when he's been on the floor as well, he's been a net negative. I'm going to look that up while you guys are chatting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think Fareed just fits. I mean, granted, I agree with you guys. I'd rather have Ed Davis. I think Ed Davis is still just – he just fits better, a better rebounder, I think, than Fareed. Fareed just works with the tempo that the Houston Rockets run. He just gets a lot of easier looks at the rim.
Yeah, I like that's nothing against Reed. I think we talk about this a lot. Fit is a huge thing in the NBA. And just like, for example, Utah, I think an issue like, dude, Quinn Snyder, why are you starting Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert together? It didn't work last year. It's not going to work this year. Like, make some adjustments. Favors has looked good out there. Like, I would be open to someone making an argument that Derek Favors has looked better in this series on there by himself than Rudy Gobert has looked out there by himself just because he's moving better.
I would say he's better.
Yeah, I would say that as well. Kenneth Fareed, by the way, has been +8 in both games. So he's been positive,
I wonder how many Rockets have actually been minus, though.
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. Very, very good point. I think as well, because James Harden loves the lob threat, loves Clint Capella, loves those sort of guys, whereas, D'Angelo Russell sort of does in terms of the pick and roll sort of offense, that sort of thing. But yeah, Kenneth Reed is an afterthought in an even lesser way for the Houston Rockets than what we're talking about with Rodions for the Brooklyn Nets. But apparently, Donovan Mitchell, you put out like a player A, player B tweet on OTG, Nick. Do you want to delve into that a little bit just to give out Russell some more credit, I guess.
Yeah, so I got to pull it up real quick so you guys chat about something. Do you guys think this could be a sweep while I pull up this tweet?
No, I think it'll go 5 minimum.
Wait, what are we talking about?
Is this going to be a... Corey, pay attention.
Sorry.
We're doing a podcast.
I was going to go retweet the pod again, you dicks. I'm helping us.
Well. The language, we have possibly kids listening. We are on YouTube, so there needs to be some sort of rating. I mean, the profanity, I'm a big fan of profanities, but being a primary school teacher, I
just need a blur out buzzer for Corey when he
graduates. All right, so what's the question? What are we doing here?
Going to be a sweep or not, you bum?
No, I think Houston in 5. Unfortunately, even though there's no proof to back any of this up, I almost said the S word, but I'm going to censor myself for you, Jack. I think the Jazz can win at least one game at home. I think they are still a good team. I think I'm expecting like Joe Ingles, like the role players for Utah.
Ingles. He's an Australian. Say his name.
Ingles.
Right.
Sorry, Ingles. I think they're going to have a better game in front of their home crowd. So I'll say if they don't win game 3, it's 4. If they win game 3, it's 5.
I feel like if Quinn Snyder doesn't make the proper adjustments, they're getting swept. Like, the players can play better, but if they roll out with that defense again, it's just going to be atrocious. Right. So it's just like it's a lot of more so coaching adjustments and almost players playing better. Because I think, like, not only defensively but offensively, they're just not running things right and just things just – they just do not look in sync. They don't look like a good Utah Jazz team. Like, they look bad. They look like they're not even a playoff team playing Houston right now.
Yeah, and I don't ever want to see Ricky Rubio on James Harden ever again.
Ah, man, it's been rough. And I think this just really hurts. We're like, they just destroy Rubio's value every time Houston plays them. It's like defensively he gets worked, and then offensively they just have zero respect for his jump shot, which they shouldn't have any respect for it anyways.
Yeah.
But, Gary Neal's been the best matchup, I reckon.
Yeah.
Who? Gary Neal.
Yeah.
Royce O'Neal?
Royce O'Neal. Oh, yeah. Gary Neal's the old Spurs player.
Huh? Yeah. It's like, shit, time machine.
Well, speaking of the Spurs...
Wait, we still what do you have?
The segue doesn't work there. I've got 28% left on my computer as well. I should have brought out the charger, but give me that stat, Nick.
All right, so we got player A, over 22 points per game, over 40% from the field, over 30% from three, three assists, three rebounds, one steal, about 3.5 turnovers. Player B, 15 points, 32% from the field, 26% from three, assists, three, rebound, three, steals, 1.5, turnovers, 4.5. So... Player A has been catching a lot of heat in the major NBA media narrative. Player B has caught in some, but it's not as bad. And Player A is D'Angelo Russell. Player B is Donovan Mitchell.
I think that the name and the gravitas around it speaks like it's generally what happens. Ben Simmons, it's just some guys that just gravitate to hate. But there's also the polar opposite with D'Angelo Russell, where guys can see no wrong with him. The fan accounts that are going around. I think Donovan Mitchell has been poor this series, and he really does need to step up. But at the same time, D'Angelo Russell has Caris LeVert playing so well, Spencer Dinwiddie, whereas Donovan Mitchell has Ricky Rubio. Like we've been seeing his negative praises, his negative criticism quite consistently, but. I think that D'Lo hasn't had a great series, despite the stats sort of speaking that he's been all right. He's scoring okay, but he hasn't been efficient enough. But Donovan Mitchell needs to step up in a massive way, especially when they get back home. And I expect him to. I think that he'll probably be the individual MVP of Game 3, and I think that'll help them get the win.
Yeah, I think for me, why we probably don't talk about Donovan Mitchell is the fact that the team in general just getting blown out. So it just, I mean, yeah, we can poke on him because he is the best player on the Utah Jazz team. I think he just kind of folds in with everybody because they're just getting obliterated.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. I guess if your team's getting cooked, they're not going to really blame you. They blame everybody. But if you're losing closer games, it's on one player. But
right.
I just feel like for guys that are around the same age, I think people react like D'Angelo Russell so differently because he's been in the league for so many years. So this is his first playoff series. He's 23 years old. Donovan Mitchell turns 23 in December. So it's not like they're far off. And this is the first series D'Angelo's ever played in the playoffs. This is Donovan's second year, obviously a sophomore season.
Right. And like we mentioned too, there's still that the slight bad narrative that follows D'Angelo Russell for whatever reason. I know that us three, I mean, obviously you guys don't, and I don't give a damn about the phone thing, but for some reason he still has this negative rap around his name for some reason, which he's clearly not the same player, not even the same person. Between those Laker years, between the 2 years in Brooklyn, he's just not the same kid anymore. So I think that's the difference too. Is Don Mitchell's never had, he's been lovable since his rookie year. We've all loved him almost more than Ben Simmons his rookie year. So I think that's also something that gets thrown into their conversation. Yeah, there you go.
Exactly. Well, enough about that. We got to touch on two more series: Portland and OKC. Portland is up 2-0. I think it is somewhat surprising, not completely surprising, but Portland has looked really good in the first two games, and OKC has not.
I don't think it's that surprising because Paul George is not healthy. And yeah, he can say what he wants, but he's not healthy. And he's the best perimeter threat. He's the only guy that can consistently hit threes. They've shot like 10 of 61 or something horrible, 10 of 33 or something really, really bad. They're shooting like less than 20% from three.
Disgusting.
They've been horrible. Whereas the Blazers have Damian Lillard shooting threes from half court and Russell Westbrook not even worrying about it. I think that Russell Westbrook and Paul George are being outplayed by Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum. And Enes Kanter is outplaying Steven Adams in some respects, in certain, maybe as a rebounder mainly. Steven Adams has still been okay, and I'm not going to speak badly about Steven Adams ever because he is a glorious, sexy Khal Drogo Aquaman. But I think that going home will benefit OKC greatly. I'm not sure how many jabs Paul George is going to need in that shoulder to hit a couple of threes and hit a couple of shots. But it's as simple as that. The best player in this series, talent-wise, is Paul George, but he is also the least healthy, it seems to be. So I think that they're probably going to go down in this series. And because Damian Lillard and CJ are healthy at the right time, it's going to benefit them. And they're going to possibly even get to the Western Conference Finals.
Do you think, you said talent-wise, do you think it, like, just based off this season that he's clearly better than Damian Lillard, or in general, like long-term, Paul George is a better player than Dame?
That's a deep question. I think Damian Lillard's consistency goes under the radar, and Corey and I on this exact platform have had arguments about Damian Lillard and Kyrie Irving before. I think that Damian Lillard is probably outplaying Kyrie Irving right now, but at the same time, that's a discussion for another day. I think Damian Lillard probably is a better player, but in a more crowded position. You know, he gets overlooked for Kyrie Irving, Stephen Curry, these sort of guys. He's the second best point guard in the NBA right now. I think that, you know, that's not a hot take. It might be for some who are Kyrie Irving stands, Corey. But also, I think that Paul George is playing in a wing position, which, and I think he's a much better defender and is probably, you know, a defensive player of the year candidate when on his day. I think that Damian Lillard, long-term consistency, but in terms of small sample size this season, Paul George was awesome. I'm going to get my charger because if we're going to chat hoops more, you're not going to see my face for a little bit, but I'm going to get my charger.
Okay, right. Do you, Jack. I think Dame's probably the better player, to be honest, just for the fact that a lot of credit for like whoever facilitates the offense, it gets overlooked. It's like if you have a quarterback, like you have really good receivers, like you still have to get them the ball. And like that's what Dame does. He's not like the king of assists, but he still runs the show in Portland. Or Paul George, he's not necessarily running the show in OKC. There's still Westbrook there. So I think Dame probably is the better player. I think Paul George probably had the better season. He has more of the two-way impact. But Dame is more of like he's leading your team.
Yeah, I mean, so this is a really interesting conversation actually between comparing Paul George and Lillard. I think consistency-wise, offensively, I go with Lillard all day because Paul George, we know, has been Right. He's just inconsistent.
Too, where it's just like he's terrible for like a week.
Right. Even when he's healthy. So it doesn't. Yeah. I mean, two-way ability. I think when it comes to defense, Paul George is miles ahead of Damian Lillard on that side of the ball. But I think like impact on the floor, you can maybe make a case that Damian Lillard is more impactful than Paul George. You know, if Paul George is more consistent offensively, then maybe I would lean towards Paul George because he is such a defensive stud. But like you mentioned, I mean, Lillard has to distribute. Lillard has to be the offensive juggernaut for this team. And as of right now, you know, Jack trying to put words in my mouth, but I think Lillard, as so far in these playoffs, has kind of pushed himself into that top three and the second best point guard in the league conversation. He's on the biggest scale playing against another top five point guard, Russell Westbrook. And I think about that clip where Russell Westbrook's like, I've been beating that ass for years. Like, you know, I've been beating it. And then today, and then Lillard came out this year and was like, I don't give a damn what you think.
Hold this real quick.
He's like, you've been doing it for years, but this is now. This is right now. I don't care about last year or the years before. This is now. Like, Lillard is just playing another level. And I did not think CJ McCollum was going to look this good through two games. I wasn't expecting it. I thought he was going to have to work into it from the injury, and he's been great. And then fact of the matter is, as Jack mentioned, Paul George, I mean, he shot 50% from the field, 11 of 20. So he was actually – he didn't miss a single He missed three shots from the field outside of the three-point shot. He was 2 for 7 from three. So he was decent. But again, if OKC isn't going to hit threes, if Russell Westbrook's going to shoot 25% from three and not be efficient from the field, he was 5 for 20 in game two. The Thunder have no chance because their role players once again have disappeared. And we're back to the story of, does anybody want to show up and help? Whereas Portland has had everybody doing just enough to help Lillard. What was that in my mouth? Lillard and McCollum get by.
Yeah, just to touch on the Dame point, I absolutely love the way he started the series when he came out and just, like, dropped that three from deep as hell. And, like, the fact he's just getting into it with Westbrook, there was the play where, like, Westbrook pulled up from three. Yeah, and then he went down the next position and just drained the three. I was like, yo, you are just mean. You are mean. James
Harden,
that's
mean.
Dog, that was fire. I just love Dame, and the series has been so much fun. And you mentioned CJ. Like, I'm not going to lie, my stock on CJ this entire year has been kind of on the decline. Like, this series has kind of given it a little rise.
Yeah, we had him. He was, like, one really big discussion point for me and Corey when we were doing the top 50 as well.
You didn't have him in your top 50.
Yeah, it's okay. Like, I guess it's time for me to catch some. I guess, based off this series, he's, you know, playing like a top 40, top 30 player. And I think he's one of the more underrated two guards in the league. I think his shot-making, footwork, dexterity is something that goes – he's very crafty, very, very crafty player. He reads a lot of film. He's a student of the game. And I think that, you know, with – you know, we talked about, you know, Golden State and their sort of down spiral. I think that the Blazers are doing enough that if they just – it benefits them to just be around. Like, you don't have to be the championship contender because things can fall your way eventually. There's still youth enough on their side. And, you know, Jusuf Nurkić gets back healthy in 6 to 12 months. Who knows what could happen with this Blazers squad? I've always been a fan. You can't not be a fan of Damian Lillard. I don't really know many Dame haters out there apart from bloody Russell Westbrook. He's just a tremendous player and the best NBA rapper going around.
And you know also who's been impressive is Enes Kanter. Like, he's been really solid for them stepping up. Game one, I know I didn't get to watch as much in depth in game two. Game one, though, I felt like defensively he was pretty solid for them. They're also getting some contributions from other guys. Like, Seth Curry's not having a bad series. He's shooting 71% from three in the series. Holy shit.
Yeah,
Aminu's got 8 points a game. Harkless, 8 points a game. It's nothing crazy, but when you have two really good guards in Dame and CJ, and this goes all the way back to when we were doing the game one recap of Nets and Sixers, you have two really good guards, and they're both playing well. It's extremely tough to defend because most teams don't have two guys that can lock down two guards.
And I want to say this, too. I mean, game two Kanter wasn't really a giant factor. He got into foul trouble early, but they were not bailed out, but Myers Leonard and Zach Collins stepped up and played fantastic in a split role. I mean, Zach Collins in 14 minutes had 6 points, 4 rebounds, 1 steal, and 3 blocks. I mean, that's fantastic. Then I know Portland Twitter was really high on Myers Leonard in his stretch because obviously he fell out of the rotation when they got Kanter and they stopped using him, and he had to step up, and he was great. Like you mentioned, like, you know, Curry shooting 70%. Like, all the role players are just hitting their shots and being effective. And when the other side doesn't have that, like, offensive rebounds in game two, OKC had 13 offensive rebounds. Portland only had just 7. Portland wins by 20. Like, those numbers don't normally add up to that.
Yeah. Guys, I got a question for you. How many players on OKC are shooting over 30% from three?
None.
Two.
One. Markieff Morris, who's playing 13 minutes a game and has taken two threes in the series. Everybody else is under 30%. Terrence Ferguson, 28, is the next highest. Third is Paul George at 27%. Russell Westbrook is shooting 10% from three.
Oh, my God.
And everybody else on the team is shooting 0%, including Dennis Schroeder, who's averaging 4 threes a game.
It seems to me
Grant is averaging 4 threes a game. Both guys, 0%.
And I think Jerry and Grant was shooting like 39% from three. A lot of these guys were shooting well in the regular season. Obviously, the playoffs, it's a completely different ball game. But it'll be interesting to see if the Thunder do flame out, what they do moving forward around Paul George and Russell Westbrook. They've never had great three-point shooters. They've, like, Alex Abrines is gone. You know, I think there's family reasons, personal matters going on there. They've just never been able to build a roster around, you know, Westbrook for one, and now Westbrook and Paul George. They're going to need some sharp shooters. And whether those guys are out there on the market, you know, that I think that Corey sort of mentioned Wayne Ellington as a free agent. They need to throw some money at a guy like that because they don't really have
money to throw.
Exactly, because they don't want to get into that luxury tax either. You know, they gave Jeremy Grant a new contract, I think $9 million over per year for 4 years. Steven Adams is on a near max contract as well. So there's not a lot of money going around unless this team wants to eat up into the luxury tax, which for a small market team seems unlikely. So thinking big picture, going forward, this Thunder team, you know, whether they're, you know, we've sort of, I remember I had them as one of the contenders, but things can change so rapidly in the space of just one playoff series.
Yeah, I mean, it's not looking good for the squad. And sorry to cut you off, Corey.
Yeah,
I don't think they've put in shooters around OKC since they had KD and Westbrook. That's always been an issue for them where they weren't really spacing the floor enough. They're always kind of behind the trend in terms of spacing the floor. And I don't think they'll have enough money this summer unless they get really creative to add more three-point shooters.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say what you just said, the sentiment that they need to add shooters, and you can't really add shooters. And maybe it's a change in system. Maybe if you fire Billy Donovan, which as of right now looks almost like a must. If you have two first round exits with Paul George, Westbrook, and Adams, I just don't think that's acceptable for management purposes. Obviously, they've tried to build a team around defense. It was nice for the first half of the year. Then post All-Star break, the defense got really bad. And then we see what we see now in the playoffs. But
you can't play. You can't have a great defense if your point guard isn't going to defend the other team's point guard at a high level. And the way Westbrook has talked all that shit. And then in certain series, you know, in certain moments, he stepped up. But in other moments, he's like laying off Dame after he's dropping threes from 5 feet behind the 3-point line. Yeah. It's just not going to work.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember against a Houston Rockets game earlier in the regular season where Russell Westbrook was locking down James Harden. He has the tools. A lot of these superstar players, Kevin Durant, LeBron James, have the tools and capabilities to be good defenders, and if not very good defenders. It's just that their energy wanes because there's so much burden on the offensive end for a guy like Russell Westbrook to create, to make shots, and all the rest. It's just you cannot let him guard, you know, Damian Lillard. You need to put Terrence Ferguson on him. You need to do something a little bit better. Whether Billy Donovan has the reins to do so is another thing. It is another question.
All right, guys, before we push this to 2 hours, let's touch on San Antonio and Denver, which has been a really exciting series, arguably maybe one of the most exciting series of the first round. You had Derek White go crazy in game three, and then you had Jamal Murray pretty much save the series for Denver in game two.
It seems to me that the Spurs are going to win this. Am I going crazy in saying that?
Yeah, it'd probably be my first bad prediction of the playoffs that I picked Denver. Corey's going to take the nod on this.
Yeah.
I picked Spurs in seven, and it looks like Spurs in five. Hey!
Oh, come on.
I mean, realistically, Jamal Murray catching fire in game two. I mean, the Spurs should have won game two. They were dominant for the first three quarters. Obviously, Denver scored 39 points in that fourth quarter. So they deserved it because you get that hot and Jamal Murray went 7 for 8 or 8 for 9 or whatever he went and went absolutely crazy. Then once again, in game three, Jamal Murray had what? 6 points. So once again, the inconsistency of Jamal Murray strikes again. That is the biggest issue with Denver is the fact that they can't get consistent guard play. Will Barton, 4 points. Jamal Murray, 6. Gary Harris, 12. If those guys aren't going to play consistently and efficiently, they're just not going to beat the San Antonio team, especially when, as you mentioned, Derek White has all of a sudden become the lovable NBA child of the league all of a sudden. Phenomenal on defense, 36 points last night. DeRozan was solid. DeRozan was fantastic in game two. He was solid again last night. San Antonio, again, I think it comes – I mean, obviously – Denver's having players not show up, but I just think Coach Pop is just a better coach. And I just think that's what we're seeing in this series so far. I just feel like he's been better at kind of maneuvering how to limit Jamal Murray, how to not let Jokic get too much involved. Obviously, Jokic was near a triple-double again last night, but he just doesn't feel as dominant as some of the games I saw him in the regular season.
Yeah, I didn't get to watch the game last night because I was traveling from the Nets game. But from what I've read and saw some tweets about, Denver just can't really defend San Antonio. You know, if Derek White's going to beat Jamal Murray that bad, and then you got Will Barton on DeMar DeRozan or whoever it may be or whatever matchups are thrown out there, it seems like the only player on Denver who's really playing with the edge that you need for the playoffs is Paul Millsap.
Yeah, he's been great. And I think in that sense, that's where Corey was sort of saying the coaching battle. They see the weakness in Jamal Murray as a defender. He has some quickness. He has effort. But in terms of Derek White just being able to bully him with strength, he doesn't have experience in any sort of sense. But he's just attacking.
That's what he said in his presser.
He does exactly. But he's just attacking like an absolute madman. So I think that a lot of credit does go to Greg Popovich, and I think that it's almost like a real clash of styles. The experienced veteran team in the San Antonio Spurs with some young come ups and guys like Derek White, their backcourt's going to be really nice next season with DeJounte Murray coming back too. You add in a guy like Patty Mills off the bench. It's insane. It's almost just like, till the day we die or until Greg Popovich is no longer in the league, the San Antonio Spurs are just going to be a bloody good NBA team. And it looks like they've proven all of us wrong yet again.
And a fun little stat that I pulled up. The Spurs had just 6 turnovers in game 3.
That is crazy. The Nets had 6 turnovers in the first quarter, if I'm not mistaken, yesterday.
And also, I want it to be known that at halftime, the turnover differential, the Nuggets had, I believe, 5, or they had 6, and the Spurs had 5 or 6. So the Spurs either had 1 or 0 turnovers in the second half, or Denver had either 5 or 6 because they had 13 on the game.
And 5 or 6 turnovers in a half isn't bad. That's 2 or 3 a quarter, which is reasonable.
All I know is the Spurs were flawless, basically, with turnovers in the second half. So I went to bed around halftime for this game.
It just proves the point that this team is just so well-drilled, so well-coached. They know their style. They don't stray away from it. They don't try to do anything fancy. They don't shoot a heap of threes. They don't need to. They just do what they do well. They focus on themselves. Greg Popovich has always said in the regular season, he doesn't scout other teams. He doesn't care to scout for other teams. But when it comes to the playoffs, that's when you see the coaching prowess on full force. I think Greg Popovich now, after the last win that they had, not this one, is the most winningest coach in NBA history, I believe, if not in the playoffs. So he's an absolute marvel. The game is going to be so much worse when he leaves. I hope he sticks around for eons and eons to come. He is an absolute treasure.
Yeah, no, it's really crazy. And I'm really interested to see what happens with the series, especially what if. So it looks like Portland has a good chance of winning. So does San Antonio. So we see a Portland-San Antonio second-round matchup.
That'd be nice.
Which is fun, yeah.
And one of those teams is going to the Western Conference Finals. Jack brought up the point of kind of just hang around in the West and something good can happen. Portland could end up in the Western Conference Finals. They're not going to beat Golden State or Houston, but they could get there, which is still an accomplishment in itself.
Exactly. It pays to just be around. And, you know, this sort of where Denver was sort of tanking a little bit in the regular season so they could get the favorable matchup, it seems like the basketball gods could be biting them in the butt. That's how you swear, Corey, without actually swearing, by the way.
That's that clean cursing. All right, guys, any final thoughts before we get out of here?
Nice long one for everyone who's listening on iTunes and the rest, Blog Talk Radio. But all the listeners jumping in the chat and the fans and everything, it's always a fun time chatting hoops with you homies.
Yeah, 100%. I appreciate you guys not watching Orlando and Toronto and watching us instead. That means a lot. But as always, thank you guys for listening. Check us out iTunes, Black Talk Radio, GBasketball.com, Google Play, and YouTube.
Peace out, knuckleheads.